or that we survived, Prabowo said to me, that was an imbecilic operation. And he objected to it, not because of the hundreds of Timorese the army slaughtered, but because they did it in front of us. And because they did it in front of us and we survived and were able to report it to the outside world, and other foreign witnesses like Max Stahl were able to do the same, we were able to get the U.S. Congress to, over time, through grassroots action in the United States, cut off for a while the U.S. Arms supply to Suharto, which helped to lead to Suharto's downfall, according to Suharto's former security chief, Admiral Sudomo. So Suharto said that was imbecilic. He said, you don't do it in front of outside witnesses. You do a massacre in an isolated rural village where no one will ever know about it. And Prabowo was able to stage his series of coup attempts over the years, in part because he had the support of the Indonesian army, which was in turn backed by the United States. He, in particular, was the Americans' favorite. He described himself as the Americans' fair-haired boy, and he had the support of the Indonesian oligarchy as well. And he certainly has their backing in this election. And with regard to Israel, Prabowo, after he became defense minister, made a special effort to draw Indonesia closer to Israel. The two countries do not have diplomatic relations. The Indonesian population now is outraged by the slaughter, the genocide that Israel is conducting in Gaza. But Prabowo was attempting to bring Israel closer to Indonesia. There was already a covert relationship with Israeli intelligence and with the Israeli military, where intelligence equipment and training was given. And Prabowo, started working with Trump and later Biden to attempt to bring the two countries together, similar to what other predominantly Muslim countries did under the Abraham Accords. Prabowo met with a senior Israeli security advisor. When this came out, he was forced to retreat from this policy. And at this moment, the Indonesian government and Prabowo are posing as if they oppose what Israel is doing. But if he becomes president, there's a very good chance that those relations will grow even closer and perhaps be formalized.
Alan, finally, the former Supreme Court Chief Justice, retired now, tweeted out that you should be captured as you give out this information. Are you concerned about your own safety? I think we just lost our connection to Alan. Alan Nairn, longtime investigative journalist, has been covering Indonesia and occupied East Timor for decades. East Timor has since become an independent nation. We'll link to his new piece in The Intercept, Indonesia State Apparatus is Preparing to Throw Election to a Notorious Massacre General. The election is Wednesday, February 14th. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Gaza, to Israel threatening to launch a ground invasion of Rafah, where over a million displaced Palestinians have sought refuge. On Monday, President Biden hosted King Abdullah of Jordan at the White House. During public remarks, Biden initially described Israel's operation in Rafah as, quote, our operation.
Yesterday, our military operation in Rafah, the major military operation in Rafah, should not proceed without a credible plan for ensuring the safety and support of more than 1 million people sheltering there.
Jordan's King Abdullah condemned Israel's plan to attack Rafah and called for a ceasefire and the creation of a Palestinian state.
We cannot afford an Israeli attack on Rafah. It is certain to produce another humanitarian catastrophe. The situation is already unbearable for over a million people who have been pushed into Rafah since the war started. We cannot stand by and let this continue. We need a lasting ceasefire now. This war must end. Seven decades of occupation, death, and destruction have proven beyond any doubt that there can be no peace without a political horizon. Military and security solutions are not the answer. They can never bring peace. Civilians on both sides continue to pay for this protracted conflict with their lives.
We go now to Toronto, where we're joined by Dr. Yasser Khan. He's a Canadian ophthalmologist and eye surgeon who recently returned from a humanitarian surgical mission at the European Hospital in Khan Yunis in Gaza. Dr. Khan, welcome to Democracy Now! If you can describe what you saw there in Khan Yunis, the level of the injuries, how crowded the European hospital was, the threats people were facing there.
Thank you very much for having me. Well, you know, I look at the impending invasion of Rafah and the attacks in Rafah, and I know, because I've seen it, I know what's going to happen. I know the casualties, and I know how much worse it's going to get. When I was in Khan Yunis a few weeks ago, I've been to over 40 different countries, you know, doing humanitarian work, anywhere from in Africa, Asia, and South America. And there, what I saw in Khan Yunis were the most horrific scenes in my entire life, and I hope I never see them again. It was just, you know, the bombings were going on every few hours at that point in time. The Israeli forces were about a kilometer away, and the mass casualties kept on coming in. And it was mostly, I mean, the majority of the patients that I treated were children, anywhere from the age of 2 to 17. I mean, I saw horrific eye and facial injuries that I've never seen before. Eyes shattered in 2 6-year-old children with shrapnel that I had to take out. Eyes with shrapnel stuck inside. Facial injuries. I saw orthopedic injuries where, you know, limbs just cut off and dangling. I saw abdominal injuries that were just horrific, and it was just mass chaos. There's children on the floor, unattended to. With head trauma, people suturing patients without anesthesia on the ground. It was just mass chaos and really horrific, horrific scenes. And I know that now with the bombing going on in Rafah and scenes of children hanging, exploded, and, you know, half their bodies cut off and hanging on a wall because they've been exploded. I mean, those are scenes going on now. So I know exactly what my colleagues are going through right now in Rafah. And in Gaza, basically.
And doctor, you were working shifts of 12 to 13-hour days. Can you talk about the conditions of the medical staff and the doctors you worked alongside with? Where did you sleep? How were you able to eat? Can you talk about those conditions you faced?
Yeah. Well, the doctors were amazing. I mean, the Palestinian doctors were amazing. Their dedication and their will to resist dying and staying alive was amazing. They're very talented, but they have nothing. There was no antibiotics. There was no painkillers. On the last day I was leaving, we ran out of morphine, which is very important in a lot of orthopedic injuries. So patients were, the whole European Gaza hospital was at the time. Now, it's everything I'm seeing now, and everything I saw is much worse now. But basically, it was overcrowded, about 300-400% over capacity. There was patients and bodies lying all over the hospital floor, inside and outside. They had orthopedic devices coming from their legs or their arms. They're getting infected. They're in pain because they're on the floor, so the conditions weren't very sterile. And if they survived amputation the first time, the infection would get them because then they'd have to be amputated after. A lot of the kids that I saw, and more than 60% of the patients I saw were children. They're thin. They had no fat on them. They're starving because, as you know, Israel has had a food blockade since this war on Gaza started. And so they're all thin with no fat, starving, and they're coming in. And, you know, we didn't have enough supplies, enough gauze, enough antibiotics, enough instruments even. The instruments are rusting to kind of, you know, deal with the mass trauma.
Dr. Khan,
I stayed in the hospital. Yeah.
Dr. Khan, this is Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland speaking Monday ahead of a vote on the $95 billion aid package to Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan.
Madam President, I want that to sink in. Kids in Gaza are now dying from the deliberate withholding of food. In addition to the horror of that news, one other thing is true. That is a war crime. It is a textbook war crime. And that makes those who orchestrate it war criminals.
That's Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen on the floor of the U.S. Senate. Dr. Khan, you're talking about the thinness of the children, of the whole population.
Yeah, well, you know, Amy, it's, you know, from what I saw and what I experienced when I was on the ground speaking to officials, speaking to the doctors there, and this whole, you know, one of the whole aspects of this war in Gaza, you know, the genocidal intent of Israeli politicians, the Israeli army, has been clear. What is really bizarre is they haven't hid it. They have openly called for it. They've openly called for epidemics. And so as a healthcare professional, the attack on the healthcare system has been unprecedented. I mean the viciousness of it, the killing machine that Israel has unleashed on the healthcare system, I think is unprecedented. Hospitals have been bombed. When the doctors have tried to repopulate them, they've been, you know, sniper fire with drones has prevented them from going in. They've attacked the sewage system, the water system, so the sewage mixes with the drinking water, and you get diarrheal diseases, bacterial diseases. You know, cholera, typhoid is not far away. Hepatitis A is epidemic there now. They're living in cramped spaces. They have killed over 300 or 400 healthcare workers. Doctors, nurses, paramedics, ambulances have been bombed. This has all been a systematic sort of, by destroying the healthcare system, you're contributing to the genocide. What's going on is now there's 10 to 15,000 bodies that are decomposing. So it's raining season right now in Gaza. So all the rainwater mixes with the decomposing bodies, and that bacteria mixes with the drinking water supply, and you get further disease. They have kidnapped about 40, 45 doctors that have been specifically targeted. They've targeted specifically specialists who are, you know, one-off. So like the one nephrologist in the Gaza Strip was targeted. The pathologist, hospital chiefs and directors have all been targeted through drones or targeted missile strikes. And, you know, so the whole thing is that if the bombings are not going to get you, then disease will surely get you because they're all malnourished. So as you know, if you're malnourished, your immune system is weaker, so you're more susceptible to disease, but there's no antibiotics. You know, the amount of amputations I saw, in children, for example, both arms, one arm, one leg, both eyes gone. You know, both eyes amputated basically out of their eye socket. You know, it's amazing. I mean, it takes about, you know, if this was done properly in a non-war scenario, one amputation in a child will need about 9 to 12 surgeries by the time they're an adult, you know, for prosthetic fitting and whatnot. Now, in this case, first of all, it's a war situation. They've not been done properly. Fair enough, because you have to rush it. But secondly, who's going to take care of these children, mostly children, because their parents are gone, their uncles are dead, their grandfathers and grandmothers are dead. And so, you know, the Israeli killing machine has been vicious. I mean, they've used drones. When I was there, I was speaking to the doctors who were there, and they told me that they've used drones like the Hellfire drone, that is an explosive drone. It fires off these discs once it implodes or explodes. And these discs are very unique and they cause unique amputations. Most amputations occur at the weak points, like the elbow or the knee. But they cause, you know, mid-thigh, mid-arm amputations, which are much more complicated. And they fire off the shrapnel. And, you know, from what the doctors are telling me that, you know, what I believe is that they're using weapons on the civilian population that have never been used before. Because from what I heard, based on my experience, you know, Israel has a very strong defense industry. And buyers like weapons that are battle-tested. So if you can put a label to a new weapon that's battle-tested, that increases the value of it. And they're experimenting with these weapons from what I've heard and from what I saw in a civilian dense population. So it's just, it's been vicious, really, really vicious.
Dr. Yasser Khan, I want to thank you for being with us. Canadian ophthalmologist, eye surgeon based in Toronto, Canada, just recently returned from a humanitarian surgical mission at the European hospital Khan Yunis in Gaza. When we come back, we'll be joined by climate scientist Michael Mann, just awarded $1 million in a defamation lawsuit against two right-wing critics. Back in 20 seconds. It's Still Today by Hallelujah Chicken Run Band. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to the climate crisis. Dozens were arrested Monday outside President Biden's campaign headquarters in Delaware as members of Sunrise Movement called on him to declare a climate emergency. Some held signs that read, fund climate, not genocide. This comes as world-renowned climate scientist Michael Mann has been awarded more than $1 million in a defamation lawsuit settled last week. Mann initially filed the case in 2012 against two right-wing critics. Rand Sinberg, then with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, wrote that, quote, Mann could be said to be the Jerry Sandusky of climate science, except for instead of molesting children, he's molested and tortured data, unquote. Of course, Sandusky's the convicted child molester and former football coach at Penn State University, where Mann was a professor at the time. Mark Stein, a contributor to National Review, cited Sinberg and called Mann's research, quote, fraudulent. Dr. Mann said he hopes the unanimous verdict in his defamation case against the two makes it clear that falsely attacking climate scientists is not protected speech. He's joining us now from Philadelphia, where he's the presidential distinguished professor of earth and environmental science at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Mann, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you explain what just happened in this major victory being awarded $1 million by a Washington, D.C. jury after suing these two right-wing climate deniers?
Yeah, thanks, Amy. It's good to be with you. You know, as you quoted me before, this is a line in the sand. It's one thing to disagree with the findings of scientists. You know, people have the right to do that. It's one thing to criticize scientists. And within the scientific community, good faith criticism, skepticism is a good thing. But what's not allowed, what you can't do, is make false allegations about scientists in an effort, of course, to promote an agenda in this case of climate change denialism. And this is something that we've encountered for decades, efforts by the fossil fuel industry and their hired guns to attack and attempt to discredit scientists to prevent meaningful action on climate. And so this is a line in the sand, and I think it goes beyond climate science. I think it also applies to other areas, public health science. Today we see bad faith attacks on, you know, public health scientists like Anthony Fauci, my good friend Peter Hotez. That is not protected speech. You can't engage in false and defamatory attacks on scientists. And so I like to think that this will create some space now, that scientists will feel more comfortable in leaving the laboratory and speaking to the public and policymakers about their science and about the implications of their science, knowing that there are some basic protections.
And I wanted to ask you, in your conversations with fellow scientists, what is the mood or the sense of how these attacks are affecting their ability to do their work?
Well, you know, especially young scientists, what I fear is young scientists see these very visible attacks, these denunciations of their fellow scientists in the public sphere. And that sort of chills the public discourse. It makes them basically afraid to speak out and to speak up. And so I do think that these attacks have had a chilling effect, and that was their intended impact. Of course, the climate change disinformation machine has used vilification as a way to intimidate scientists, to create fear that they'll be attacked if they speak out about the implications of their science. That's been going on for far too long. It's now infected our entire body politic, where today misinformation and disinformation runs rampant. And when it comes to the great challenges we face, whether it be climate change or the public health threat of pandemics like COVID-19, it is absolutely essential that scientists feel free to speak to the public and to policymakers about these mounting threats. And I hope, once again, that this decision will create a little bit more space now for my fellow scientists to do that.
And do you see your case setting precedent for political leaders who attack climate science, And how badly were you injured? I mean, this horror of comparing you to this known molester who destroyed so many young men's lives at Penn State.
Yeah, well, you know, I was certainly, there was an emotional toll that it took on me for certain. You know, it didn't prevent me from speaking out about the climate crisis. I have embraced that opportunity. My recent book, Our Fragile Moment, is my latest attempt to communicate the threat of climate change to the public and to policymakers. I've been able to do that. But at the same time, it's taken an emotional toll, it once again has sort of created this chilling effect where other scientists, seeing me attacked in this way, have probably backed off and have shied away from the spotlight. And we all pay the price when scientists don't feel empowered to speak out about the implications of their science.
I want to bring into this conversation Mark Hertzgaard, executive director of Covering Climate Now and the environment correspondent for The Nation, where his new piece is headlined, "It's the 2024 election season. Where's the climate story?" Welcome back, Mark, to Democracy Now! Lay out what you're calling for in this election year 2024.
Thanks, Amy. And I have to say that the comments that Michael Mann is making right now about how the climate denialism has intimidated scientists into not speaking about their findings, that has happened exactly the same way within our profession of the news media. For too many years, many of our colleagues in the media have been intimidated by these right-wing attacks and have come to think that, well, I don't really understand climate science. I guess I better not talk about it. And you see that now in the election, 2024 election, which is that there's a lot of coverage, obviously, about the campaigns, especially here in the United States at the presidential level, but very little connection of the fact that these elections are essentially going to shape humanity's climate future, and not just in the United States. About half of the world's population is entitled to vote in various elections around the world. We just heard Alan Nairn's report from Indonesia. Very important election there. India is coming up, European Union, U.S., South Africa, Mexico. These elections are going to decide which governments are in power or not in power over this next critical five-year period when we absolutely have got to bend the climate pollution trajectory down if we're going to preserve a livable planet on this future. So these elections could not be more important from a climate perspective. And yet a lot of the media is still not making that connection. And I can tell you that part of the reason is a fear on their part. I just had this conversation the other day with a very prominent journalist, fear that we will look partisan if we point out, for example, that here in the United States, one of the major political parties is still essentially denying climate change. That's the Republicans, of course, and Donald Trump, who has pledged to drill, baby, drill from the first day back if he were to be returned to the White House. It's not our job as journalists to censor ourselves because one party or one candidate decides that they're going to deny climate science. We owe it to the public to report that to the public without fear or favor.
And I wanted to ask you, Mark, in terms of how the Democratic Party has been handling the issue of climate change during this election season, because there couldn't be a more stark difference between the two candidates in terms of climate science, at least in terms of their acknowledgement of the crisis that we're facing. Right. But is the Democratic Party really pushing forth as strongly as it could on this issue?
You know, Juan, I think it's hard to know. I because so much of what we in the public hear about from the Democratic Party or from the White House is filtered again through the prism of the news media. And for example, the Inflation Reduction Act, certainly the biggest climate legislation ever passed, probably in the world, certainly here in the United States, and passed, by the way, by a Democratic president through a Congress that is still has a lot of Republican control in it. The White House has been very frustrated that the general public does not know about that. And the White House has tried and tried, it says, to put Biden on the road to talk about this. And it's not getting the kind of press coverage that at least I would have expected. So I think that you're certainly right that there is a huge contrast between a Democratic and a Republican approach to this. Is Biden's climate record perfect? Far from it. The U.S. is still now the biggest oil and gas producer in the world. You know, he green-lighted the Willow Project, oil project up in Alaska. But he just put a pause on liquid natural gas export facilities across the Gulf Coast. So as voters, I think it's very important for people who are out there as citizens to remember that, to quote my colleague Rebecca Solnit, when you're thinking about your vote, your vote is not a Valentine, with all due respect to Valentine's tomorrow. Your vote's not a Valentine. It's a chess move. You don't have to approve of everything a certain candidate does in order to say, I'm still going to vote. If you care about climate, vote. If you care about fairness, vote. If you care about peace, vote.
This week, Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez marked the 5-year anniversary of the introduction of the Green New Deal.
We are going to go, and we have to go to every single frontline community and ensure that they are not left behind. We're going to create millions of unionized jobs across the United States of America. We are going to revamp our transmission lines, install solar, commit to geothermal, and we are going to transition this country to clean and renewable energy and create a sustainable working class in the process of doing it.
Mark Hertzgard, we just have 30 seconds, but again, that's AOC celebrating now 5 years since Green New Deal was introduced.
And that Green New Deal is what gave us the Inflation Reduction Act, somewhat trimmed down from the original vision of the Green New Deal, but that's where, again, elections are important. AOC ran, took on a moderate Democrat who everybody said was unbeatable. She beat him and injected all of this new energy and great ideas into the American political discourse, like the Green New Deal. And I think that's exactly why we in the press have to be paying much more attention to the climate issue here in 2024.
As the Northeast is shut down by what is expected to be a monster storm. It just recently started snowing here in the city. The schools are closed from here to Boston. Mark Hertzgard, Executive Director of Covering Climate Now, will link to your new article in The Nation. It's the 2024 election season. Where's the climate story? And thanks so much to Michael Mann, Professor of Earth and Environmental Science at University of Pennsylvania, just awarded $1 million in a defamation lawsuit. Happy birthday to Brendan Allen. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.